on your candidacy.
Okay.
And remember, the new Hillary is humble and gracious.
Yes, got it. I know this election season won't be easy. I'm sure I will face some stiff competition from my fellow Democrats. People like Martin O'Malley, who could really give me a run for my money. I'm sorry I broke. It's too funny. Martin O'Malley instead of me. He sounds like a Simpsons character. Let me keep going.
And that was Saturday Night Live's Kate McKinnon as Hillary Clinton practicing her I'm running for president announcement in an online video. The real online video announcement came the next day, yesterday. Meanwhile, Senator Marco Rubio told donors this morning that he will officially announce his candidacy tonight. Coming up, a critique of the candidate launches. But first, continuing our series on the California drought.
We must tackle our drought crisis head on, whether it's replacing your lawn, your sprinklers, getting a pool cover, showering with a friend. I can't believe that's in here. Hopefully it's somebody you know well. If you don't take action, Sacramento is going to mandate how we tackle our drought.
Mayor Eric Garcetti talking about the city's new Save the Drop campaign to urge Angelenos to conserve water. Well, UCLA has just come out with its environmental report card, and LA County's water gets a C. That's a general grade for quality, how much we use and where we get it from and more. The good news, Angelenos have clean, safe drinking water, and it's safe to swim at the beaches, at least when it's not raining during the summer. But the report finds that even though we use about 16% less water than we did in the year 2000, we still have a long way to go when it comes to conservation. Stephanie Pincel is director of the Center for Sustainable Communities at UCLA and one of the authors of the report. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Nice to have you. Well, how much water does the average resident here in LA County use?
Well, we know what the average resident uses in LA City, which is about 125 gallons per person per day. And I think average in the county is a little bit more than that. But, you know, there are some cities like down in San Gabriel that use around 56 gallons per person per day. So it does vary quite a lot depending on where you are. Long Beach uses about 70 gallons per person per day.
Okay. So let's just take the 125-gallon figure, and that's actually an improvement.
Well, we've done a lot with replacing replacing toilets and conserving indoor water use. The big area where we need the transformation is clearly outdoor water use. Over half of water in the home is used out of doors,
and that's on lawns and other plants.
Yep, it's really the lawns. Lawns are the big culprit in this region.
Mm-hmm. And so, not swimming pools per se.
Swimming pools, if they're full and you have a cover on them, you know that water's already in there. So I would not recommend filling swimming pools at this point. But as long as your swimming pool is full, emptying it isn't going to change anything.
Right. Well, how do we compare to other cities in the United States that don't have similar drought problems?
Well, that's a really good question. I was doing a little bit of research before this call, and in the city of New York, I found a 2009 number that said 125 gallons per person per day. And you have to remember, New York is much more than just Manhattan. It's the whole area, including all of the boroughs. And, of course, they get much more rain than we do. So it's interesting that even in places like that, they still use a bunch of water. I looked at the area around Chicago, and luxury home developments there use way over 200 gallons per person per day, but some areas use down to 85 or less, particularly in places like mobile home parks.
But when you look at places like Australia and Europe, it's a lot less. Is it actually comparable? Because in Europe, at least they get more rain and it's more urban.
Sure. I don't think it's quite comparable in Europe, but I do think it's comparable, particularly for Southern California, to look at Australia, where they actually have had and have very, very severe droughts and have really finally bitten the bullet. and addressed outdoor irrigation. I am still surprised to see really green meat planting strips along streets. I mean, I understand that we need to keep our trees watered because they're really important to mitigate the urban heat island effect, and very, very important. But all that grass, really, we should be letting a bunch of that grass dry up. And we should do much, much more about changing out our landscapes, because we could reduce, we would actually be almost fine if we reduce the outdoor landscaping irrigation to the point where we're really climate appropriate.
So in Australia, they've reduced their water use to, I think, about 38 gallons a day per person on average?
38 to 40, yeah.
Yeah, and again, compared to our 125 gallons. So did they do that primarily through restricting outdoor landscaping?
A lot of it was through restricting outdoor landscaping, absolutely. And I think, you know, being more conscious about the amount of water that we're using indoors, we can put in even more efficient toilets than we have. There's a whole new generation of really low flush toilets. Being aware of how long you're in the shower, having water efficient dishwashers and washing machines, and just being a little careful about how you use water would go a very, very long way.
So I think maybe a lot of people are a little put off by the initial investment cost to do that, to rip out their toilets and buy new ones or buy a new dishwasher, that kind of thing, when they compare that to how much they pay on their water bill.
Well, that is also the other problem, right, is water is actually relatively inexpensive. One of the things that my colleague Terry Hogue and I, who looked at water use in the city of Los Angeles with the National Science Foundation grant, recommended was to consider over time installing indoor and outdoor water meters. And that way you could really price indoor water at one price and outdoor water at a higher price. And of course, we need to increase the tiers for water consumption. You know, when you're using a lot of water, you should really pay more money for those additional 100 cubic feet of water that we're using.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what is the biggest problem indoors?
Probably still toilets, but we've done so much better with the toilets. It kind of depends on, you know, how careful you are in how much water you actually use, I think. We could take very, very long showers. That'll use a lot of gallons of water, or shorter showers. You know?
And how many gallons roughly go down the drain per minute?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't know. It depends on the shower head.
Yeah. But an average shower, let's say an average shower of 5 to 10 minutes, how much water would that be, do you think?
I wish I knew. I don't.
And what about toilets?
Well, toilets, I think, are down to, I think there's some toilets that use 1.6 gallons per flush, but I think they're a little higher than that. But that's still pretty good.
Okay, so the mayor has recommended that we reduce and get down to maybe 100 gallons per day, mm-hmm. per person per day. Do you think that's doable to cut 25 gallons per person per day in LA?
Yep. I think that for lots and lots of households, that would not be very hard and would not mean using less water indoors. It's really about that outdoor water use. If you realize that over 50% of the water you use is out of doors, it really means you have a lot of flexibility to reduce water use. You can put in better sprinkler systems like drip systems that target the bushes and the trees that you really want to keep over time. They're much more efficient irrigation systems, even for lawns. There's a huge amount that still can be done in outdoor landscaping, and it will not really affect your quality of life in terms of eating what you want to eat, washing your clothes, doing all of those things.
All right. Stephanie Pincel, Director of the Center for Sustainable Communities at UCLA. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, as Stephanie just said, lawns are considered the big culprit. But now we welcome Jim Baird, professor of botany and plant sciences at UC Riverside, who says that perhaps lawns are being unfairly demonized. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Melvin. Thanks for having me.
Well, I don't know if you just heard the previous guest, Stephanie Pincel, but she literally said that lawns are the big culprit. They are more than outdoor use is more than half of the water that we use. And if we just cut back a little bit on that outdoor use, we'll be fine. So what do you say to her and everyone else who's saying that lawns are a problem?
My gosh, I feel like the Rodney Dangerfield of the plant kingdom here. I mean, it would seem as if turf is responsible for all of our woes with water.
Okay, well, so defend your square of green.
Well, you know, I think a lot has to do with how you water your lawn and the type of lawn species you have. We can start there. When I moved to California, the cool season grasses like tall fescue, Kentucky bluegrass, but predominantly tall fescue, is kind of the king of the lawn grasses in California. And it's because if we water it and we rely on Mother Nature, we can have green grass year-round. However, there's a set of grasses called warm-season turf grasses, Bermuda, buffalo grass, zoysia, seashore pastbellum, cocuyah, St. Augustine are the main ones. And this group of grasses uses at least 20% less water than the cool-season grasses, which most of us grow on our lawns in the state. So right off the bat, I mean, you could save a lot in terms of the species you use.
Hmm. So you could rip out your lawn and put in a different kind of lawn and it would be okay?
Yeah, but that's not what those who are giving people money to take out their lawns, that's not good enough. And I think the argument from their standpoint is, well, how do we know that if we're giving X homeowner such and such money to do this, how do we know that they're actually going to do that? How can we tell? And certainly, I think, I could tell the difference, but I can understand that maybe they don't want to go, lawn to lawn and to actually determine, is this a warm season species versus a cool season grass? So the way things stand right now, you cannot, take out, at least for cash, you cannot take out your lawn and replace it with something that's more water efficient.
Well, why do you like lawns over drought-tolerant plants? Why do you think that lawns are a good thing?
Well, I mean, I'm 50-something, and I grew up not in California, but in another semi-arid location, Colorado. And as a child, I mean, my afternoons, weekends were spent playing on the lawn. And although it's not what my kids do now, they're like many on their iPads, iPods, whatnot. The hope is that their children and children's children will someday have that luxury of playing on the grass. And so that's just one aspect of why I think the lawn is important. You know, the recreational benefits, certainly the aesthetic benefits and property values that the lawns provide to homes. And then I think most importantly are the environmental benefits, the temperature moderation, the glare reduction, noise reduction, soil erosion control, carbon sequestration, et cetera, et cetera. There are certainly many benefits of having turf in the landscape.
Well, can you separate that out versus the trees in terms of the overall heat island effect?
Well, certainly trees are beneficial, and the shade that they provide, it provides a cooling effect. But from the turf standpoint, like other plants, like trees, I mean, there's a process called evapotranspiration, which is analogous to perspiration evaporating from our skin. And what does that feel like? It feels cooler. So there's a cooling effect from these plant materials, and that's something that, we as Californians, especially in such an urban setting, we should be aware of, and that by taking out all of this vegetation, namely you know, turf grasses, that that's going to have an effect on warming the environment. And last time I checked, I think at least close to 70% of the energy production in the state is tied to water. So it's kind of a vicious cycle there. We take out these plant materials and then we warm up the environment, and then we need more energy to cool it, and that energy requires water. So mm-hmm. It's something to keep in mind.
What do you think of people painting their brown grass green?
Well, we've certainly done some studies with that in the past, and again, I am one of those Californians who put his money where his mouth was. When I moved here, I changed my lawn from tall fescue to Bermuda grass. And so first thing I did when that happened, I was written up by my HOA for having brown turf. And so we've experimented with some colorants, and that's one primary use is on warm season turf, where these grasses are, except maybe along coastal environments where the ocean moderates the temperature, these grasses are going to go dormant or turn brown in the winter. And so colorants are an effective way of keeping that grass green, if you will. I think, you know, more recently there's certainly discussion about using them to kind of, you know, in the drought situation, where if you've got to cut back, then you can help keep the lawn greener. While I maintain that let's teach Californians how to water or irrigate their lawn in the first place. And so I heard your previous caller about you know, how much is used you know, in the landscape, and how much, or in the home setting, and mm-hmm. how half or more than half is used outdoors. Well, that's certainly true, but then it comes down to, you know, how are you using that water? And I just can't believe, you know, lived in California for 8 years, and when I moved here, I thought, wow, everyone must be really interested in saving water in our climate. And I found nothing could be further from that point. You know, people irrigating their lawn 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I mean, that's just not good management. And you know, the turf, our grasses get the blame for this. And really, it's those who are irrigating them that are as much to blame for as anyone else or anything else.
Jim Baird, professor of botany and plant sciences at UC Riverside, who is defending the lawn and the prudent watering of it. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What have you done with your lawn in the drought? Have you put in drought-resistant plants? Have you replaced your grass? Maybe you have artificial turf. Have you painted it green? Are you keeping your lawn nice and emerald? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we are going to assess the announcements of the various presidential candidates, including Marco Rubio today and Hillary Clinton yesterday, and what it says about which voters they want. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hillary Clinton has officially declared her intention to run for president. She dropped a video announcement yesterday.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president.
Her campaign tagline, New Adventures, Next Chapters. Marco Rubio is up next. He'll announce his candidacy officially to voters in Miami tonight. He announced to his donors earlier today. And Rubio joins an increasingly crowded GOP primary ticket. Both Rand Paul and Ted Cruz tried to make a splash when they announced they were in the race. For more on the announcement strategies of those who've announced so far and what it says about the voters they're courting, we're joined now by David Graham. He covers political news for The Atlantic. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
First off, that SNL spoof that we played at the top of the show touched on something that Hillary Clinton's camp is obviously pretty well aware of, and that is that she needs to come across as more personable, more relatable. And how has she struggled with that in past campaigns?
Well, you get there's sort of two different Hillarys, I think it's fair to say, in the 2008 campaign, for example. Early on, she was this juggernaut. You know, her campaign couldn't lose. They had all this momentum. They had all this money. And she seemed very distant. Once she was in the hole and Obama was up, it was like a different person on the campaign trail, and you saw her, you know, throwing back Boilermakers with union men and choking up in restaurant appearances, and people were really impressed with that. The question is which Clinton shows up on the campaign trail, and they're trying to do everything they can to make sure it's the second one rather than the first one.
Yeah, right. And so I wonder if you could parse this video announcement that was shown on Sunday, and where she featured everyday Americans making fresh starts. There was a stay-at-home mom returning to work, a gay couple planning their wedding, a man starting a new career as a blue-collar worker. And so is that the demographic that she wants? Are these the voters that she's courting?
Yeah, she's trying to show this sort of multi-ethnic society, and you know, the gay couple, I think, is an essential sort of symbol mechanism. I think the fact that she doesn't appear until well into the video is also significant. It's intended to suggest that there are real people behind this, and this isn't just, as her opponents would suggest, you know, one woman's endless quest for the presidency.
Right, and it's also sort of a symbol of new beginnings, I suppose, and younger people in the video. It's
right, exactly.
And trying to link to that. Okay, so by contrast, Marco Rubio, he leaked to donors earlier and is expected to announce his candidacy officially tonight in a big way at Freedom Tower in Miami. And what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's one, he's sending a big signal about the Cuban-American community and about his roots. He's trying to show himself as being somebody grounded in place. And I think Rubio, and also this is true of Rand Paul and of Ted Cruz, they're seeking a way to set a big splash with their announcement. They need to get their names out there and really get some attention. Everybody knows who Clinton is, and so her task is to not appear inevitable. And Jeb Bush had a similar thing. You know, he was able to announce on Facebook because he's a known quantity. Everybody knows who he is. With Rubio, there's an idea of trying to get some momentum and trying to capture some of the attention that has really followed Ted Cruz and Rand Paul since their announcements.
Yeah, well, and also to maybe introduce himself to a public who doesn't really know who he is.
That's right. He's still not a very well-known quantity. Republican voters are very open to him, but his polling is not huge. And I think outside of Florida and outside of D.C., he's not as well-known.
Yeah. Well, what is also the significance of announcing before Jeb Bush announces?
There's a competition going on in Florida for donors, for political talent, for sort of getting the home base. And I think Rubio understands that he is at a disadvantage in that battle. You know, Bush has a longer history there. He was in elected office for longer. He has connections to the Republican establishment outside of Florida. And so Rubio wants to gain as much of that momentum as possible. You also see in some of his rhetoric taking on Hillary Clinton as being yesterday's flavor. You notice that cuts a couple ways, too, because he can imply that Jeb Bush is also yesterday's flavor without having to say so explicitly.
Well, and by turning on his mentor, the guy who championed him in the first place.
That's right. There's a long suspicion that he wouldn't run if Jeb ran. And instead, what's happened is he's decided to go ahead and do it.
Right. So he's 43 years old. And is that going to be a big deal that his youth is going to be played up either, you know, on the part of his supporters or his opponents who say he's inexperienced?
That's tough to say. I think he's definitely going to play it up as his angle, and he represents a more forward-looking sort of vision. I don't know how it'll play for his opponents. Bush has a lot of experience, certainly, but some of the other politicians in the field are also relatively fresh. Scott Walker hasn't been in a statewide office for very long. Ted Cruz is a first-term senator. Rand Paul is a first-term senator. So what you have is really a lot of young Republican candidates who've been in office for a while and have some experience to point to, but they're definitely a younger crop.
Okay, and let's talk about the three who have announced on the Republican side, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, about to announce officially. And they are all supported by, or they were all had a lot of early support as by Tea Party supporters, proponents.
Yeah, that's right.
And so pretty conservative. And so how are they going to distinguish themselves in terms of their ideology?
So I think one thing we've seen, go ahead,
for Republican voters in the primaries.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing we've seen already is how that Tea Party label has splintered a little bit. So these guys were all Tea Partiers when they were elected, and you see they've taken different areas. So Ted Cruz is really making a play for the social conservative voters, the religious right, and that's what he's going for. And also as somebody who has particularly aggressive tactics. Rand Paul is playing up this constitutional conservative angle, which is a way to sort of put a different face on libertarianism. But he's really worried about things like civil liberties, and you see him being more dovish generally than other opponents about war issues. Rubio has staked out a kind of different territory. He is conservative. His faith means a lot to him, but he's not as faith-forward as Cruz is. He's concerned about foreign policies on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's been fairly hawkish, which is a contrast to Rand Paul. So you see them all sort of developing their own niches, and I think foreign policy is a big one for those three. You put a guy like Scott Walker in who doesn't have much foreign policy experience, and that changes things in yet another way.
Yeah, right. So I guess Marco Rubio is trying to position himself somewhat in the middle, but that's going to be a problem when Jeb Bush announces.
Yeah, I think Rubio's great hope here is that everybody else burns out. He seems to be the second choice for a lot of Republican voters. People like him, but they don't love him. So his play really is for other candidates to hit their ceilings or to flame out or to commit egregious gaffes. And then he can say, you know, I'm electable, I'm good-looking, I have this whole range of things. You know, I'm conservative, but I'm not too conservative. I'll appeal to moderate voters. You should all coalesce around me. So I think that's his strategy.
Okay. And then just finally, on the Democratic side, any contenders at all, any serious contenders to the nomination for Hillary Clinton so far?
Martin O'Malley is gamely out there beating the drum and campaigning and saying there shouldn't be a coronation. But the polling really tells the story, which is that none of them seems to be really gaining any kind of traction at all. And Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be the only person who could, is steadfastly staying out of the race.
David Graham covers political news for The Atlantic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And what do you think about the candidates' announcements so far, the race so far? We have a lot of months to go before the election. Are they overdoing it in the age of social media, or do you like all this pomp and circumstance and back and forth political stuff? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Twitter at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, how the profession of the Hollywood writer has changed. A new book goes behind the scenes after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Writers are some of the most creative and influential people in Hollywood. They're also often the least respected.
Look, you're confused. You need guidance? Talk to another writer.
Who?
Oh, Jesus. You throw a rock in here, you'll hit one. Do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
That's from Barton Fink, the Coen Brothers film about a New York playwright who's lured to Hollywood only to find out it's a writer's nightmare. That may be true, but so many people still want to be screenwriters. And there are as many how-to books for writers as there are aspiring writers. A new book, though, isn't about the art and craft of writing and how to get into Hollywood. It's about the job of writing and how it's changed over the last 100 years or so. Miranda Banks spoke with 50 of the biggest scribes in Hollywood, and she looked at 100 more oral histories to create the book called The Writers, A History of American Screenwriters and Their Guild. She's an assistant professor at Emerson College in Boston, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, we do have a stereotype of the Hollywood writer, and it is largely Barton Fink, kind of a nebbishy Jewish guy. It's a little anti-Semitic, I have to say. That stereotype.
Right. That was created by a writer. If you think about Sunset Boulevard or adaptation, it is always these guys that never really get it together in a lonely place. Even in The Player, you have the writer as the bad guy. And it is kind of funny that writers create those kind of personas for themselves.
So they're self-hating is what you're saying.
Of course.
Of course, because they're sitting in a room by themselves. They don't like what they're doing, and yet they want in, and they're not respected.
Right. And that's the film story. The TV story is a little bit different. There you've got the examples of The Dick Van Dyke Show or 30 Rock, where you get a little bit of a different kind of struggling writer. But there is that sense of that they are both entirely at the start of a project. They are the center of a project, and yet they're always outsiders.
Yeah.
They're, you know, rarely on the set, rarely involved in the entire process unless they're a producer. And so they are there from the beginning, but they also are pushed aside pretty early on after the blueprint is there that they've written. They're kind of set aside, and then the real making of something begins.
Is that also true in television? It seems to be a little different these days because you've got showrunners who are writers, like, for example, Matthew Weiner in Mad Men, Shonda Rhimes, Scandal. You have these very powerful showrunners who are also the writers.
Right. That has been an issue between film and television writers for a long time. And if you actually go back to 1954, the formation of the Writers Guild as a community that included film and television writers, and actually radio writers as well, there were debates about who was the most important person in the room. It was obvious that the screenwriters had more clout and more power because at that point, TV writing was very small, and it was a new career. But at the same time, the TV writers had so much more power than film writers had. And so very quickly within the Writers Guild, TV writers became the most powerful people in the guild, but, you know, they were writing Duffy's Tavern, not, you know,
From Here to Eternity or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about the history then, because it starts out in Hollywood, and we're talking mainly about film, that these are basically writers for hire. They're not considered exalted wordsmiths. They're just cranking out scripts.
Right. And in those days, actually, there were a lot of women who were writers. In the days of the silent films, I think it was about 1925 or so, where there were actually more women writers than there were men. The most, you know, most famous writers, Frances Marion, Anita Loos, great writers. And then money started pouring in, and also new writers came in from Broadway, from, you know, novels. This is the kind of Barton Fink moment where...
When you have like Dashiell Hammett and you have William Faulkner.
Exactly. And they all come in because of sound film. So because of sound, they needed new dialogue. They needed a different kind of writer. And so everything was shifting in the industry at that moment. And a lot of those people who had had power as novelists, you know, when they became screenwriters, they said, wait, we don't own our own scripts. We don't have that kind of power. And that's when they kind of started saying, maybe we need a guild.
So a guild, is it a union or is it an organization of craftspeople?
Great question. It depends on who you talk to. People who are considered craft workers like to consider themselves a guild.
So less blue collar, more white collar.
Exactly. Maybe what I'd argue is less blue collar, more artistic, that's what they think of themselves as within the world of unions. It's a blue collar kind of title. A guild sounds like a community of artists.
But then as we talked about, when you have powerful writers who are showrunners, that's no collar. They're at the top of the heap.
Right. But they're at the top of the heap because they're producers.
Ah.
Not because they're writers.
So you can't be at the top of the heap if you're just a writer.
Pretty much not. I mean, unless you're somebody quite extraordinary. Patty Chayefsky was somebody who said, I'm a writer and I want all the power that I can have. But for the most part, officially, a lot of the power comes as a producer.
As you did these interviews and you looked at the history of Hollywood writers, have the complaints remained the same, basically being we don't get no respect? Because some writers are paid handsomely for their work. They don't have a lot of room for complaint.
Right. Writers have always complained. The complaints change a little bit. And you can't really compare the highest paid writers to the experiences of the average writer. And often what I found with the writers that I interviewed, that when they talk about the lack of respect, they're not talking about themselves as the highest paid writers, but they're thinking more about the times in their career where they were not so well paid.
What is the biggest complaint?
Power. I think power is an issue. And the other issue would probably be the possessory credit. So the possessory credit is on a film, it will say a Michael Bay film. And writers have a real problem with that because, you know, it's not their film. And they'll generally say it's a collaborative project. You wouldn't put the editor of it, but without editing, we'd all be sitting there for, you know, 6 hours watching a movie. So that is one place where they do really feel like there's a lack of respect or understanding about what the process of making a film is.
But isn't part of the problem that those films are often written over and over and over again, those scripts, that there isn't just one writer? There's
right.
a fleet.
Exactly. And I think that that's a serious problem these days, is how many people are involved in projects. But that hasn't changed since the beginning. One of the things that the Writers Guild in its earliest days asked for was that writers were allowed to go to the premieres of their own films. But...
What, were they not allowed to?
No. Sometimes they didn't get invited. But one of the other things is they said that the Writers Guild itself should be the arbiters of whose name is written on a script, because sometimes it would end up being the last writer that wrote on something, maybe not the writer who actually had done the most work. And sometimes, rarely, but sometimes it really did end up being a producer's cousin or friend or something that would get the writing credit.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Miranda Banks. Her new book is The Writers, A History of American Screenwriters and Their Guild. Now, it seems that Hollywood writers really like to go on strike. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate mail for that, but they, or at least they seem to be at the forefront of the labor movement here in Hollywood. And they've been on strike, what, some six times?
Yeah.
I don't know any other group in Hollywood that's been on strike as often.
Yeah.
Why?
So that was one of the questions that I came to this project with. And, you know, and I asked every single one of my writers, and they came up with all sorts of ideas. Some of them said, because we're the most lefty. Other people said it's because the story starts with us and we feel the most intent about the whole process because it starts in our heads. But the other thing is that writers all do the same thing. And so there's a cohesion within the Writers Guild that isn't there in the Directors Guild or in the Actors Guild. The Directors Guild has unit production managers, and it has first ADs and second ADs. Writers are writers. And it's also a very small union. So in some ways, they can understand each other as a unit very well. But then I think that there is an issue of the fact that writers are both necessary but dispensable as individuals in a way that actors are not. They can be pushed around and moved out of the way, and that's part of what the story is of the writers. That's kind of why I love the story, is they are replaceable but desperately needed at the same time.
So the institution is needed, but the individual players are replaceable.
They are. And yet at the same time, of course, they're not replaceable, because there's nobody that can write like Frank Pearson. There's nobody that can write like Patty Chayefsky. There's nobody that can write like Matt Weiner, except for, of course, all the people that write with Matt Weiner.
Exactly. So it is a collaborative effort, though, right?
Absolutely.
When it comes to writing TV, I don't know about feature films, but I know there are writers' rooms when it comes to television.
Right. And part of what it is to be a staff writer is to learn how to write in somebody else's voice.
So, Miranda, you interviewed a lot of writers for this.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of encounters with them. Who was your worst interview? Can you say? Can you talk out of school?
Who was my worst interview? Well, one person would only talk to me on the phone while they were in traffic. And that was a real disappointment in terms of just feeling like they really didn't understand what I was doing. But I was grateful. And thankfully, LA has terrible traffic, so we got to talk for a long time. But far better than that was everybody who said yes. The thing that's funny about writing a book about writers is I'm the one person who wants to talk to them who's not asking them to read their scripts. And, you know, I'm not asking them for a job. I just want to talk to them about their lives. And I had the incredible experience of talking to brilliant people and hearing amazing stories. And part of the great joy of writing a book about writers is they tell good stories.
Tell me a good story that you heard.
So I was talking to Carl Reiner, and everybody knows the story of the writer's room in Sid Caesar. You know, the Sid Caesar show had this incredible writer's room, and everybody was in there. It was Mel Brooks and Woody Allen was in there. You know, it was just incredible. And I said, you know, tell me about the writer's room. And he said, oh, well, you know, it wasn't really a room at first. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, for a long time, they just put us in the stairwell. They're like, we didn't really have a room for a year or two. So here we are, the greatest writer's room, the kind of first writer's room that everybody talks about was actually a stairwell. So I love that.
That does say it all.
Yeah. One of the other great stories I uncovered was Julius Epstein. He and his brother, Philip, they both wrote Casablanca. And Jack Warner sent a note to all of the writers. And he said, you know, everybody else on this lot comes in at, you know, a decent hour and leaves at a decent hour. And here you are, writers coming in and out, you know, at odd hours. You need to come in by 8:30 and leave by 5 to get your work done. And the story that he always tells is, so they go into Jack Warner and they say, we figured out the end of Casablanca. And he says, what is it? What is it? And they said, oh, we thought of it at 7 a.m. We can't tell you. We were off the job.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Miranda Banks, she wrote the new book, The Writers, A History of American Screenwriters and Their Guild. And she also teaches at Emerson College in Boston. Coming up, the results of all that work in the writers' rooms. We'll get our TV critics' take on last night's premieres of Game of Thrones and Veep, and what they say about what we want from TV next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. HBO was all about politics last night. Game of Thrones season 5 premiered. And what is this series if not a political drama? And with somewhat less nudity and gore, a lot less nudity and gore, Veep also premiered last night. Selena Meyer has officially made the title of the show obsolete for season 4. And to talk about all these things on TV today, Sarah Mesley is here in the studio. She's humanities editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books, where she writes for the Dear Television column. Welcome back, Sarah.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. And let's start with the biggie, Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
You're a huge fan.
I'm a huge fan.
Okay, let's play a clip from last night's premiere.
The Seven Kingdoms need someone stronger than Tommen, but gentler than Stannis. A monarch who can intimidate the High Lords and inspire the people. A ruler loved by millions with a powerful army and the right family name.
Good luck finding him.
Who said anything about him?
Who? So will it be she?
Many of us hope so.
And she being Cersei?
No.
No?
No, no, no. She being Daenerys, the mother of dragon, beautiful blonde.
Okay, so this is the beginning of a season that goes beyond the books for the first time.
Yes.
And
yes.
What does that mean?
Well, let me just start off by saying that I think that the season premiere was a really excellent hour of television, which was surprising because there were many obstacles to this, at least a couple of reasons. One is, as you say, the show is kind of departing from its roots for the first time. Two, last year, I think, was the big breakout year for Game of Thrones, so I'm worried that there's a little bit of burnout. And also, at the end of last season, they had this very dramatic ending where some of the relationships we cared most about had been ended dramatically. So the question is, can they pick things up and put it back together? What I think was really great about it is how they made that tension at the center of the show. And they said, we're going to make this exciting storyline about how what you think you know is coming from the books may or may not actually be the case.
Is it possible for those few of us who have not been watching this regularly to just drop in right now and pick up? Or is it just too convoluted and there's too much has happened and you really have to start over at the beginning?
I think that it would work. And here's why. Because Game of Thrones rewards at basically every level. So it's exciting if you're deeply enmeshed and have these deep emotionally entrenched relationships with the characters and you've been comparing things to season one. It rewards on that level. It's very smart on that level. But the dialogue is great. It's beautiful. The clothes themselves not only complement the storyline in fascinating ways. You can tell whoever is doing the costuming is just so smart about how it's reflecting character all the times, but are just gorgeous and amazing. So it's high drama in the moment and it's high drama in the long scale as well.
Now, news broke that four of these episodes, the first four episodes, were leaked and are now available for anyone who wants to pirate them. Is that just causing a huge stir in the Game of Thrones world?
You know, it's interesting. I think that this the Game of Thrones, the transition it's making this season as it's moving away from the book is it's making everyone to think about, what do I want to get out of television? What's fun about television in the first place, right? And because Game of Thrones does so many terrible things to the characters that you love, it's always making you think about, why am I watching this? I'm choosing this. You know, like, why am I watching a bad thing happen to, you know, this nice person in a pretty dress? So there's this question of, why am I getting out of it? And I think a lot of people are saying, actually, what I'm getting out of it is watching it on the couch with my friends, cringing in terror. And so people, I think, kind of want that delay. But on the other hand, a lot of people want to be the experts, right? That's the people who've read the books, and they're sorry that the show is diverging from the books, and so they're not going to get that pleasure of being the expert and telling the show. And so those people are going to, like, jump to this, like, oh, I've got ahead of the story, now I'm the expert again, right? So I don't know that there's a right or a wrong way to do it, but I love watching this conversation play out about the different things that people are trying to get out of TV.
Let us move on to another HBO show, Veep, which also premiered last night. And at the beginning of season four, we find Selena Meyer in the Oval Office.
Gary?
Yeah.
Do you have my hand cream?
Oh, yeah. I got the new formula from La Prairie.
No. Just give me the whole tube, because you can't come into this next meeting either.
And I'm totally fine with that. You
know? Hey, Gary?
Yeah.
What is the coffee that the Navy stewards use?
Oh, I can only imagine.
It's heaven.
Oh.
It's like Colombian tongue sex.
Wow.
Why don't we ever use that coffee?
I don't know, but you love our old coffee.
Yeah.
No.
I have to say, their relationship is extraordinary. I love watching it play out.
It's Gary and
Selena.
You know, it's hard not to compare it to the clip that we just listened to, which is this other intense relationship. And it seems like here, you know, like Gary and Selena, that it's working out all of these dramas with pleasure rather than misery and hatred, you know? So,
well,
it's
maybe
so
misery on the part of Gary, because he's miserable,
right?
He's being shut out.
But does it make us miserable? Like, we were laughing, right?
Yeah,
it's a totally different thing that it offers to the audience. That there's a certain cringeworthiness that I think comes with Veep 2. Watching people embarrass themselves or be ashamed.
So how do you think that it is, how do you think it's lasting now in its fourth season, and with the tensions between the characters and the comic timing, do you think it's still
good?
Well,
I mean, it's still spectacular. You know, I have not spent as much, like, deep, close attention to Veep as I have to Game of Thrones, but it's still offering those same sort of thrills. The question that I have, of course, in election year is it going to get so close to the truth that the stakes are raised, you know, with the Veep premiere the same day that Hillary Clinton announces her run for the presidency? You know, it's one thing to be the vice president, who is sort of bumbling and we don't expect them to do anything. But when, now that she's the president and the stakes are real, there's a great moment in the pilot episode where she says, oh, I'm the president, everything's my fault now. And it's like, that was a joke, but it's also not a joke. How are they going to navigate these higher stakes? Are we going to be able to have it be a respite from political tension, or is it going to actually feel too close to political tension? For me, that's the big question of this season.
Another big question is, what's going to happen when Armando Iannucci is no longer running it? He announced this is his final season, that he's leaving the show, and that someone from Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think, is joining.
I think so, yeah.
And so what does that mean for the show? And what does that mean in general when showrunners are now huge celebrities, or at least they
are
well-known?
And have their own fan base, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, there's a lot of people, again, the question of pleasure of TV. People like associating themselves with certain showrunners. And I think there's that kind of smugness that comes, like, oh, it's not as good now that the showrunner left, you know? So who knows? I mean, I can't speak specifically to what this new showrunner will do. But I do think that having a new showrunner won't change Julia Louis-Dreyfus's amazing comic timing. It won't change the chemistry that she has between Buster. So I always call him Buster.
From Arrested Development.
From Arrested Development, right, which is the great thing about that character. He's always both for me. But I do think that the vibrancy of that relationship will be there regardless. So maybe in some ways the cult of the showrunner doesn't always tap into what's joyful about a show.
Though he does do a lot of the writing, from what I understand. And the writing is what is so incredible about that show. Apart from the acting, just how quick the barbs are and how you really have to be paying attention to get a lot of the jokes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, who knows, right? I mean, so I both want to say that the showrunner, of course, matters. But I also think that there's a little bit of a cult of personality, right? It's a way of, oh, I watch TV in this more sophisticated way. I'm affiliated with the showrunner. I understand that it's not just characters in a room. And I think that that is one thing that is a great way to watch television. But I wonder sometimes if that gets overestimated in the midst of other joys to be found sitting on your couch or in front of your laptop.
Well, we have a whole season of Veep to enjoy.
So we'll have to check base.
Okay,
later.
Great. Sarah Mesley, humanities editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books. She writes the Dear Television column for them. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the week, Jolie Myers.
Happy Monday. I'm trying out new things to be smug about now that the show has caught up with the books on Game of Thrones, because I am...
You're one of those.
Oh my gosh, I am so one of those. I might be the worst of all of them, but I think I can be a little bit smug about lawns because I live in an apartment and that's not up to me, the whole lawns thing. So we heard on the show today that we are perhaps acting a bit hasty when it comes to our lawns, ripping them up in favor of drought-resistant plants. Turns out that the grass is helping us keep cool. Well, we had a lot of listeners that wrote in on Facebook and said we haven't watered our lawns in months and months and months, and they look great. And they had specific grasses
so
that
they
suggested.
Maybe they have the Bermuda grass.
So St. Augustine was one of them. And so if y'all want to check that out, go over to our Facebook page. Plenty of stuff to look at there.
Okay, fantastic. And it's KCRW Press Play is our Facebook page. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney and To the Point is up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.